Welcome to The Note. Here with Aaron Falk, beat writer for UtahJazz.com, and I'm Angie Treasure, the social media manager for the Utah Jazz.
How's your 10-year challenge looking, Angie?
Rough. 10 years ago, none of us looked nicer, except for maybe, I mean, Kyle Korver, he looks exactly the same, let's be honest. He had more hair. It was the thicker Bieber hair in 2009.
Slight emo sweep kind of thing going on.
It was sideswept. Joe Ingles had a little more hair.
We all had a little more hair.
That's probably true.
Go on Instagram. Look, find that 10-year challenge. It is amazing. The Derek Favors, then to now, Ricky. It's a glow up.
Ricky.
5 for 5. Those are all glow ups.
They're very good. Nick Bullerjack, our social media coordinator, did a nice job finding those. And the exact same poses. Like Derek still bites his lip when he dunks. It's Joe still shoots with his left hand, surprisingly, but they're great.
Good to be at home, Angie. Jazz are winners of 4 straight, 6 of their last 7. We got 4 more home games this month.
They've won 5 straight at home.
Dating back to
the 25th. No, December 29th.
Yes.
They lost on the 27th.
But, things are really, like, we talked about the schedule easing up. Just with being at home, and Derek Favors said at Shoot Around the other day, it's like, it's amazing what happens when you don't have to get on a plane every other day to fly somewhere. Fresh legs.
They've still hit adversity with the injury bug. No healthy point guards for the last 3 games.
Sure. But we're looking at Donovan Mitchell running the point guard, averaging 27.1 points per game and 4.8 assists per game in January. This week's Western Conference Player of the Week, first time in his career.
That's a good week. Jazz haven't had a Western Conference Player of the Week since George Hill. Yeah.
So,
just a minute ago.
He is no longer in the Western Conference.
No. Shout out to the Milwaukee Bucks.
Looking back, I mean, obviously Donovan's play has been incredible, but you've got to give, I think, just as much credit to what Rudy Gobert has done for this 4-game win streak. 25 rebounds.
Tied a career high. He had the most defensive rebounds of his career with 22.
Just an especially impressive performance considering he's going up against Andre Drummond, who's the best offensive rebounder in the NBA. I think probably should direct. Can you tell people how to vote for All-Star? Because it's a little different this year.
It's a little different this year. You can go to utahjazz.com/vote and we can direct you there. But technically you can only vote through Google and Weibo. They've changed it up. You used to be able to do the hashtag NBA vote and have your player name. Not so this year. It's a little more complicated. So go to NBAUtahJazz.com/vote and vote for your guys there. We have buttons all posted for every player. So get clicking.
Through Google or, as you all do, Chinese Twitter, essentially.
Yep.
We have one, so we have game tonight, Wednesday night, at Clippers, and then back home for four more games. But we do have one event, non-game night event. We have Epe's Book Club coming up on Thursday night. That's going to be streamed live on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
What time, can you give us the details? What time is that?
And 7 to 8:15 p.m. I think is the schedule. We're anticipating taking questions from the audience. If you read The Rent Collector and want to participate. Epe is not going to answer basketball questions. He just wants book discussion. So
yeah,
be prepared.
It's a Utah author, Cameron Wright.
He'll be in attendance.
He'll be there. Yep, it should be a good time.
Speaking of Epe,
we got a feature on him on UtahJazz.com. Just kind of talking about his book club experience and just sort of his role in the locker room. He's sort of the wise veteran, the locker room sage. For me personally, I particularly love when he leaves every night when, like, the post-game scrum, everyone's waiting for Rudy to get dressed. Epe always leaves just a nugget of wisdom on his way out. Last night it was, pay someone a compliment tomorrow. Be grateful. Nice.
Have you done that?
Angie, you're a great podcast co-host.
Thank you. You're adequate.
That's more than I deserve.
Epe's got interesting perspective. Obviously, he's bounced around. He lived in Turkey. He's obviously not guaranteed playing time right now. And he doesn't seem to begrudge anyone. He's very engaged. Donovan's obviously said that Epe's been someone he leans on personally for things on and off the court. And again, with the book club tie-in, he's not just an athlete. You know, he's not one to just shut up and dribble. He's very involved. He's socially conscious, and he's just got a different perspective than you see from a lot of current NBA players.
Absolutely. He said those, you know, obviously wanted to stay in the NBA, but the 2 years he spent in Turkey totally changed his worldview, and just came back, you know, much more aware of everything, you know, these social issues that he's now taken great stake in, and just a super interesting guy to talk to. If you ever get the opportunity, maybe at Epe's book club on Thursday night, just a really, really bright guy. Speaking of interesting and I guess interesting and dynamic big men, we talked with Mark Eaton, who is along with Ron Boone eligible, like a nominee for the Hall of Fame. You know, there's another round of cuts coming up for All-Star and around All-Star break, and we'll see what happens there. But just a tremendous honor for both of these guys to be on that list. You have to be nominated by someone who's in the Hall of Fame in Mark's case. Got a chance to talk with Mark Eaton, and let's hear what he has to say. Mark Eaton, hey, thank you so much for the time. Just wondering, first of all, what it means to be eligible for the Hall of Fame and to have that nomination right now.
Oh, it's pretty exciting. It's quite an honor, you know, to be nominated. You have to be nominated by somebody who's in the Hall of Fame, and so that's pretty exciting. And you know, you don't always think of yourself as a quote unquote Hall of Fame player. You know, you just did your job, but to be recognized that way, even just as a nomination, is very meaningful.
How do you find out about something like that? Who calls you? Who tells you?
Nobody called me. I found out through a news outlet in LA that called me and told me about it. So, you know, you got to go through a couple of rounds of cuts to make it to be a finalist, but that's how I found out.
Okay. And I mean, you mentioned, you say you never think of yourself as a Hall of Fame type player, but your story is so incredible just from where you were drafted and kind of how you came. What did you imagine for your NBA career when you first arrived in Salt Lake City?
No, I couldn't, and I'll get into that in a second. But the funny part that you reminded me of is like there was like an application or something that we had to fill out, and it asked you for your high school stats and accolades, zero. It asked you for your college stats and accolades, zero. So really, I'm going into the nomination process with just my NBA stats, and yeah, I mean, I had an unusual background, not playing growing up, and working as an auto mechanic, and then having a coach convinced me to give it another try when I was 21 years old, it's an unlikely story to be sure, because I basically came in the NBA with 2 years of junior college experience and sat on the bench at UCLA for 2 years, and Frank Layden gave me a chance, and the team was in a space where they could afford to let me make some mistakes out there and kind of get my feet underneath me, and it worked out well for both of us.
Yeah, have you talked to Frank? Have you seen him recently? And sort of what has he meant for you?
You know, Frank's like my second dad. I wish I could spend a little more time with him. I know he's I saw him at lunch about a month ago, and I need to call him again and check back in with him. But I don't think he gets enough credit for what he did for the Jazz back then, because if you recall in the early 80s, for those that were around then, you know, the Jazz were losing money, they were losing games, you know, the bank was floating paychecks for players. It was just a really difficult time for the team and the franchise, and Frank had the formidable task of trying to sell the team to the community as GM and as coach, and he did it by trying to go out and get players who weren't that well known, cast-offs from other teams, but he always looked for players from big programs, because he said, you know, if you went to Notre Dame, if you went to UCLA or whatever it was, you probably understood winning. And that was his strategy behind trying to get the guys that he did. And then once he convinced us to play together as a team and stop the complaining and stop kind of being out there just seeing how many shots we could get up, things transformed and created a culture that is still a part of the team today, kind of that blue collar, play tough defense, get deflections, run an opportunity kind of a kind of strategy, and it worked.
When you, I mean, you, with your minimal background, you come into to the highest level. I mean, what was the hardest adjustment for you, and how did you sort of make those steps to become such a dominant defensive player?
Well, when you come in the NBA, you have this assumption that you're in shape, that you really know what you need to do physically, and then you get here and you're not even close to what you need to be. And so the great thing about Frank and Phil Johnson back then, even Scott Layden, is they said, you know, why don't you come to camp like a month early and let's just work out extra before training camp starts. Now, back in the 80s, too, a lot of players looked at training camp as the time to get in shape. It's not like today where players stay in shape all year round. So it was a little different mindset back then. But once I got here and started going through the drills and the running, I was like, wow, I'm not even close to where I need to be. And then the first few games when I'm playing against guys like Bob Lanier and Artis Gilmore and players like that, even in the exhibition season, I was like, wow, these guys are really strong. I mean, they can push me around anywhere I want to go. And so I decided right then that I needed to get stronger. And I worked with some guys with some weight workouts to do, and squats and bench and clean and all those, that kind of stuff, to get myself stronger, because I knew the only way I was going to survive is I was able to push people around underneath the basket, and I needed a lot more muscle mass to do that.
I mean, when you look at your defensive numbers, and especially your blocks, it's incredible, something that probably can never be replicated again in the NBA. Do you think that's fair to say? I mean, can you imagine anyone coming close to some of those records?
You know, it's kind of astounds me because, I broke the record in like 1985, and it's still standing today. And I always thought there'd be somebody that would come along and just like knock me off the block, just like I knocked. Of course, the guy's record that I broke had stood from like the mid 70s, and So it is. It's remarkable. And I don't think about it a whole lot. But then once in a while, when I go back and look at it, I go, wow, you know, nobody else had all the great centers that have come along in the league since the late 80s. And no one has even come close to breaking that number. I'm like, that's kind of crazy.
Do you have there's so many, but do you have a favorite memory of a block or a favorite game or something that just particularly stands out in terms of your defense?
You know, when Frank was teaching us when we were young, my rookie year and the second year I was here, he'd say, like if we're not going to make the playoffs, we want to affect the playoffs. We want to beat the better teams. We don't lose the game by 2 points instead of three, because 2 points is closer to winning. And it's crazy things like that they used to say back then. And so we started gunning for some of the better teams. And I can remember making a big shot or blocking a big shot on Kevin McHale late in the game against the Celtics in the Salt Palace, and we won the game. I can remember chasing Isaiah Thomas down and blocking a shot for a layup that he was trying to get at the end of the game to seal the win. And there were games like that not only did I make a good play at the end of the game, but we beat a team that was one of the premier teams in the league at the time. And I think those little plays like that helped give our team confidence that we could compete against the better teams and the bigger teams, and helped propel us forward in the years after that to say, hey, we're here. We're not the doormat of the NBA anymore. Like, we're a legitimate team. We're a legitimate playoff contender. And if you come in our house, we're going to beat you.
Yeah, you mean you give credit to Frank, but obviously the players, yourself included, to kind of establish that foundation, that we're in this, you know, beautiful remodeled arena now, and just all of these things that have happened because of the success that you guys had. Does it give you heart, I guess, to know that you were a part of that?
Yeah, it does. And because you look around today and you look at the practice facility and the arena and the millions they spent remodeling in here a couple of years ago, and you go back to the Salt Palace, and you know, which was really a rodeo arena that was all brick, had terrible lighting, and I have real fond memories of that place, because it was a more intimate setting in terms of, you know, the fans would hang around just outside the locker room after the game, you'd say, and there was only a few dozen of them, and you got to know most of them on a first name basis. And it was just a different feeling in the city at that point in time. And the best part for me was when we started winning and people started getting excited and more people started showing up, and then we made the playoffs and the town went crazy, and you had the whole, like, the Jazz Have Heart thing from like 84, and And it was just the beginning of something that was really, really fun. And so being a part of that ride from like nowhere to somewhere is probably the fondest memories that I have of that time. And it's amazing to see where it's gone and the fact the team's continued to thrive and grow and expand and appreciate and everything else that's happened in the years since. But my fondest memories are still of those early years.
You played with so many good players over the years. Do you have a favorite teammate or two? Maybe not even just in terms of quality, but just in terms of the kind of locker room guy that he was and kind of maybe helped for you.
Well, you know, when I came in the league, Adrian Dantley actually helped me a lot as a rookie because he was always in such great shape. And he was kind of a pain in the rear to play with some days. But, you know, we had some good synergy on the court, which was kind of fun. And then a couple years later, well, even that year, we picked up Rich Kelly. We made trades back then to make payroll, and that's how I got a starting job. Is they traded Danny Shays to the Denver Nuggets for Rich Kelly and like $300,000 or something to make payroll for the rest of the year, so Rich became a good friend of mine, and he was this kind of sage, wise old guy from Stanford, you know, that had played with the Jazz in New Orleans. He knew all the greatest places to go to eat. He knew that little club that was two streets over from the main drag. And we had a lot of fun hanging out. And then we added Billy Paltz the next year. The Whopper was another guy who'd been in the league. They played in the ABA and the NBA. And they called them, those two guys called themselves the American Towers. And then John Stockton showed up. Anyway, and then Thurl. And so we just had a group of guys back then. It was a lot of fun to hang out with on the road. And we didn't do crazy stuff, but those guys, I mean, like John and I talk about this because like we used to go to like Denny's to eat on our per diem, right? And Whopper shows up, Billy Paltz, he goes, no, come on, we're going to the Palm. I'm like, what's the Palm? John's like, I don't know what the Palm is. So we go to the Palm and, you know, we're sitting in this really classy restaurant. And they're bringing out these lobsters that are like 18 pounds and bottles of wine. And John and I are looking like, how much per diem do you have? I don't know, how much do you have? And those guys are just living it up, ordering steak and this. I'm like, wow, this is something else. It was quite an introduction into you know, the veteran world of basketball.
Did that in any way set you up to get into the restaurant biz yourself?
Well, I certainly got to eat some fine meals hanging out with those guys. I don't know if it set me up to get in the restaurant business per se, but when that opportunity arose, I at least knew what the difference was between, you know, good food and bad food and good service and bad service. And so that, I guess that gave me at least a foundation to work from. But man, we had a lot of fun back then.
And you still live here and you've got obviously your with your speaking engagements and your businesses and I guess I saw you walk in and you're shaking all of the ushers' hands and they know you. I mean, what is the kind of reception for you long term in this place? I mean, what's that been like?
Well, I think, you know, when I retired, it was like I was thinking, okay, where am I going to live? Where do I want to raise the kids, et cetera? And Utah's just been such a fabulous place for me. It's home, and it's, you know, it's a smaller town, but it's also a big town. And so walking into the arena is just, it's like coming home because like some of the ushers have been here longer than me. I mean, I've been in the town for 34 years, I think, something like that. And these guys have worked for the Jazz for like 40 years. So it's fun to see them and fun to say hi to them because they've seen all the guys, they've seen everybody for all the years. And they, you know, they're just a special part of this place and a special part of the community.
You're at a lot of games. What have you thought of this new Jazz and what Quinn's been able to do? And I want to talk to you a little bit about Rudy after that, if you don't mind.
Yeah, I you know, when they first hired Quinn, I was kind of like, okay, so, you know, this guy's a very cerebral coach. And it took me a little while to kind of figure out what he was doing. I knew about his quote-unquote pedigree from, you know, where he'd been before. But I think especially when Rudy showed up and then, you know, you added in Joe Ingles and some of these guys, I could see that there was a thread through the foundation of the team of what they were trying to do out there on the floor. And so it's been kind of fun to watch. He's a different kind of coach than I was ever exposed to. But he demands excellence out there on the floor, and that's what I like to see. And so, I thought last year was really fun, the second half of the season, going to the second round of the playoffs. And this year has started out a little rougher, and obviously the schedule's not been in their favor the first half of the year. At the same time, it's hard for a young team once you had success like that. You know, you have a tendency to show up the next year and go, okay, let's go again. You know, let's do it. And you forget that it takes a lot of hard work and what you have to put in, day out to really perform at that level. And so I'm looking forward to see what they do in this coming up in the second half of the season, because I think obviously the schedule's in their favor. They're playing a little bit better together now. I thought this last road trip they played much better in, you know, Detroit and Milwaukee. And and then what was the next question?
Well, and I guess I'm wondering, you watch Rudy, and when you watch other big men play, is it like frustrating for you, like do this, do that, or do you enjoy it, or what's?
I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, in Rudy, I see all this potential, and he is playing well. I mean, I'm not going to take one thing away from him, because he has done an incredible job. I think he runs the floor well. He's way more athletic than I ever was. And my only challenge that I talk to him about this once in a while is protecting the rim, because I think and obviously the game has changed since I played. That 3-point shot is a much bigger part of the offense now, and you have to defend it with a little more aggressiveness than maybe we did in the 80s and 90s. But at the same time, you've got to take care of the paint. And I see the guys get too spread out on the floor on defense, and I see players getting through, and it's like once they get through the first line of defense, they'll just go to the basket and score an easy layup, and that drives me nuts. It's like, come on, somebody get over there. And so I will text Rudy on occasion and say, hey, you know, I know you guarded your man great, like, but your job is to guard the entire team. Your job is to guard that paint. That is your house. Do not let anybody in there. And he's like, thank you, and you know, and then I see that he'll make a little adjustment here or there out there on the floor. But I love watching him, and he's exciting, and the fans love him, and he's such a gracious man. And I think the whole team that way is that the one thing that Jazz has always been great at is getting great people. And when you look at the caliber of Joe Ingles and Donovan Mitchell and Rudy and a lot of the rest of the players, even Dante, you know, he's come along well. I think that there's just a great group of guys that that I think really play well together and hang out together. And I think that's the one thing I've looked at with the team this year. I always look at, like, you know, social media, you can see what everybody's doing, right? And are they hanging out together off the court? You know, and I see more and more of that this last 2 years. And I think that's a great barometer for me as a former player to say those guys like each other out on the floor. And if you like each other out the floor, you're going to pull for each other. And that's sometimes just the little difference you need to make to really get your team over the top.
And last thing I got to ask you is just what your relationship like it has been like with Jerry over the years, sort of what he's meant to you, even you know, maybe as a person.
Jerry and I have spent a lot of time together, and I think as a coach, first and foremost, he pushed all of us. He took the foundation that Frank Layden started, and he said, okay, I'm going to turn up the heat now. I'm going to demand more. I'm going to demand more consistency and more excellence from you guys out on the floor on a daily basis. And it drove some players crazy at times because he did it, you know, ad nauseum. And his press conferences after the game were like reruns of each other, because he would just say the same things all the time. But if you look at the great coaches and the people that you quote all the time, you know, the Newt Rockneys or John Woodens or whoever it is, they get these little phrases and these little things, and they just say them over and over and over again. You say, well, why is that? Well, because it works. And so I always appreciated Jerry for that, because all he was really looking for was a great effort. He knew some nights the shots weren't going to go, but he was looking for consistent defense, consistent execution, being there for your teammates. And he was all about that. And he is that guy you'd want in the foxhole with you. And I love Jerry. He's had some health challenges, obviously, in the last few years. But he still talks a good game, and you know, when you sit next to him, you start telling stories, and it's just hilarious, some of the stuff that we talk about. But he's my coach, you know, and just like Frank was. And you just, when you play for somebody for so long, because Jerry was here as an assistant and then as a head coach, so I was probably with him for 8 years before I retired, and we've just always maintained that friendship. And when you have great coaches and people like that, it's not just a one-time deal or you're here for a couple of years. It's like a lifelong relationship. And I know there's other players that still call him. I was taking him to an appointment not too long ago, and Howard Eisley called us on the phone while we were riding along. And, you know, it's just there's players that really honor and respect who Jerry was as a coach and a person, and they love staying connected to him.
Awesome. Well, Mark, hey, thank you so much for the time, and congratulations. It's a huge honor. So thank you so much, sir. Appreciate it. Okay.